The other thing he taught me about is writing out my talk, so that, and then he told me how many words you could say in a minute. It's about 100. BBC uses 110, 120 to do the news. And he said he used to write out his talks on yellow paper, and when he came to 8 pages and 120 words, he knew he had a 10-minute talk done. That was all it was. And then, of course, rehearse, which I don't always do either. Anyway, it's all there, but I'm going to be referring to it every so often. So today, then, I'm going to mention that I start here now and talk about basically the output from our work, but also why I got involved in this business of cancer screening. And let me read a little while, even though it isn't as animated as talking about it. So I, 8 years ago, convinced CIHR to fund studies of a neglected question. The neglected question is how to measure the mortality reductions produced by cancer screening. And the website has all the output, some resources, the slides, and so on. As I said, I began to take an interest, even though I had been in oncology trials for 7 years. I'd given them up when I came to McGill. But in 1991 or two, I think Dr. McGregor, who was head of one of the Technology Assessment Council for Quebec, looking at basically, he said, writing consumer reports for the government, how should we be spending our money? And the government asked us, should we be paying for PSA tests for screening for prostate cancer? PSA, as a test, came out in the late 1880s, I think, and 1980s, and it was starting to spread like wildfire in the US. So they asked us, was it a good idea for the government to be paying for that? And I think I remember at the time we didn't have any evidence from trials at that point. Obviously, it was fairly new. Screening was new in prostate, other than digital rectal exam, but that hadn't been tested very carefully. But we did say to them, if I remember rightly, that we didn't have a lot of data on the benefits, but we thought they were small. But for sure, we had a lot of data already on the harm, and we knew that was substantial. So we said, we're not sure that it's a good use of your money to be spending it on PSA screening when there are so many other competing demands for the money. I knew during writing of that report, which is mainly from bits of data collected from everywhere, I knew about the values of trials, or the benefits of trials, and the idea of comparing two arms in a clinical trial, and you had to compare the mortality in the two arms of a clinical trial. Lots of people have always tried to do one-arm studies and survival curves and measured from the time of diagnosis or screening. And, of course, there's lead time bias in that, which you may have heard of. There's also length time bias. You probably mentioned that. Yeah, so I knew about those, but I didn't realize how bad things were, even in the trials, when those trials basically avoid those two biases. If you compare mortality in the screened and the unscreened arms. But it was a paper by Mietnin in 2002 on mammography, taking issue with somebody who said there was no benefit to mammography, and showing this guy how misguided and founded on no principles the analysis we had up to then had been. And I'll explain more about that later. But that really changed everything. I went back and retaught the medical students differently and started looking at the literature myself, started looking at the colon cancer trials that had happened at that time and were published, and found that there were problems. So the first paper on this is from 2005, and it has something about looking in the right window, the time window. And that's the essential message today, is looking in the right time window for when you can see benefits, because they don't show up right away. Then the next one then was the actual trial from Europe looking at prostate cancer screening in 7 countries, 2 arms, regular care, and screening every 2 years, every 4 years with PSA. And I was very disappointed at the result and the way it was presented in a timeless way. And I'll show you that result today in something we think is a bit better. So that got me going. And then I started looking at breast cancer and some of the others. Well, the same issue is arising there. So At that point, in 2010, we decided to look for funding and go further with this ourselves and do a proper job of, instead of complaining about everybody else and how poor their analysis was, how about we develop some methods of our own? So that's what we did, and we were it's the one and only CHR grant I ever put in, and I got it, or we got it, we got it. Yeah, so that's the beginning of it. So today, then, the aim is to introduce you to some principles, a lot of them to do with time, but also some more general things about screening. Just to give you a sense of what programs are out there, and by programs, I mean organized programs, and organized programs usually with invitations to screening every so often. And then I want to say, when we're measuring the benefit of screening, how on earth are we going to do it? What is it that we estimate? What is it that is to be measured, right? And the one message for statistical people here today is I'm on a big campaign for the last 10 years to get people off the Cox model, the proportional hazards model. It is absolutely overused, and certainly in this area, I think I can easily convince you, it shouldn't even be thought of. It can't possibly be the right model. A one-number summary for a 30-year endeavor. So, now, I haven't time to go into all of these, but ask yourselves, how many screening tests have you gone through already in your life? Do you know? Do you even know if you've had any? Yeah, certainly the women in this audience, I imagine a lot of you have had the test. The men don't even know what we're talking about, right? And they're not going to wake up until they're about 50 and somebody's going to mention their prostate, okay? But the women go through a lot, and we'll come back to that. Yeah, so here are some of the tests. And again, because this is on the web, you can look at these. I did a lot of work to put all these resources together in one place, so you actually have all the guidelines for public health for what screening should be like. But I won't even mention them. I'll just, because we're academics, talk a little bit about definitions. And just the idea that screening has many, many uses. I looked it up, and my God, the Oxford Dictionary gave me an awful lot. But the one I liked is the one in red here, to sieve or to filter. That's the original meaning of screening for us. But in fact, I'll try and convince you of using another one. There's also the medical concept of screening, and this book, which is about to come out, and I can explain later why I'm not talking more about it, but it really improves, I think, on Stedman's medical dictionary definition of screening. I don't know what one you guys use in your class, but the two key words in it were the word latent or asymptomatic. And the other one, I think, was the idea that screening is usually just the first step in a long cascade, right? And that obviously if the screening test is negative, you're told come back after so many years, but then it may, if it's positive, start to a proper workup. But it's not a diagnostic test. It's not a diagnostic test. And the women of Ireland found out about that to their horror last year as well. In Ireland, the cervical program is called Cervical Check. And the idea when you have a check and you were given the all clear that there's no cancer. And sadly, that wasn't the case for 200 women. They had missed it from 3 years before and the smear before, and it's caused a disaster in Ireland and so on. But anyway, I'm trying to push also the idea of replacing the word screening by early detection or early detection and treatment. It's a much better word, and it will explain, I think, why we could get out of the biases and the blindedness that we have in our business today and a lack of appreciation of time. And this textbook is the classic textbook that none of the modern authors know anything about, but it's still a great textbook to look at. Morrison's book, he was at Harvard. He had a lot of examples, including screening for cancer in it. McGill has one of them as the book. Then there's this new book, which is very, very good, more general, written by authors in England who have had a lot to do with UK programs. Very, very nice book. And modern, this is the second edition this year. And better than that, it's an e-book here at McGill. So that's even better. And I'll just steal borrow, whatever you want to call it, a few items from here. But this is probably the most important principle of all, and they put it right in their preface. Okay? Sorry, go back. All screening programs do harm, some do good, and some do more good than harm at reasonable cost. But that's a hard thing to find out which does what. And then here's the tension that comes between clinical medicine. I think they put it very nicely. The clinician who sees an advanced case of disease right now is thinking, shoot, why didn't that person get screened 10 years ago when there was a screening test? So it's obvious they should have been screened. Why did it get this far, right? And then they have the public health person who's trying to say, okay, let's imagine we're going to do a screening. But now we have to screen everyone to find one to help. Everyone out of 1,000 maybe, or something like that, right? And if we're going to test everyone, we're going to harm some people just to help one. So that's the tension. And so I like the way they put it. They said there is no rollback where you can go back and just screen the one that would have had the cancer. That's the biggest problem. It's a problem generally in public health. Prevention has much of the same challenges in it, I think. So there's some nice history in the first couple of ones. I'll just leave the book for you as a reference. There's some very nice historical material. You know, screening started like a lot of things. Oh, it's got to work. If we do it sooner, if we get it sooner, it's got to work. That's the general mantra. But it's more complicated than that. And the trouble is, lots of screening programs got started with no evidence. We just hope. And one of them that took a long time to die was the periodic health exam. Another one where, oh, well, it's got to be good. And there, if you go back in history, the idea of an annual checkup for cars, for people, it's a very good idea. Yeah, these were some of their early works. They actually looked at 10 of these and said that 6 of them weren't doing any good at all, were terrible, and 4 weren't great. And I'm curious what you think the 4 were that might have been okay. Any offers?
Iron deficiency.
Huh?
Iron deficiency.
Maybe now, but not then. The 4 that they came up with were deafness, the PKU, that's a genetic one, very serious one, that's easily fixed if you catch it in time and used. We're all tested for that here in Quebec now. The TB and the rhesus one. Those are the 4 at the time. Now, I mean, cervical cancer is now, I think, paying its way and doing well, but we can do better. Breast cancer, we'll see. So these guides for screening are a bit like the guides you have from Hill and on causality, right? I don't want to call them criteria, they're not. I presume you say the same thing. But they are guides, and they list some of the prerequisites for screening. And there's a lot of them. I'll just leave them there. You have them in the slides if you want to look them up if you're ever dealing with screening. Yeah, a small, just one snippet of little bits. I just randomly picked 2 or 3 books from the library to read about the early history of cancer screening. And I found this remarkable one about Germany, where they were talking about early detection. Again, mostly women's cancer, reproductive cancers in women. The US is very, very interesting. A lot of the cancer screening activities there were driven by women. They had the forerunner of the American Cancer Society, and the forerunner had the Women's Army as a campaign to spread awareness, to spread the message of early detection, to talk among themselves because they were sensitive subjects to do with gynecology and so on, and so on. And so very, very interesting. And I couldn't leave screening without starting with kind of the poster child for cervical cancer. So you're no longer probably, some of you are probably still getting the Pap test, but some of you are probably switched to HPV now. Is Pap still standard here? Yeah. So Paul is going to be worrying about this up in Nunavik, where actually they want to replace Pap by self-testing HPV. And in the conference I was at this summer, there are good reports on that might well work. Yeah. And when I saw the pictures of what women have to go through for the other one, I saw why. Yeah. But this was originally done by smear, vaginal smears, 1941, improved at McGill by a guy named Ayer, who took a tongue depressor and turned it into a spatula that would get at the cells in the cervix and used for many years. He was run out of town in 1951 for preaching early detection to the public. McGill didn't like the idea that academics should be preaching to the public about public health. So he was run out of town, went down to Florida. So today we have technology, some good, some not so good, for most of the major cancers. And I'll just list them all here first, and then I'll talk about a couple of them in particular. I'll start with neuroblastoma, which I won't say any more on, but I put a slide at the end with the four key papers on neuroblastoma. It's again in all of the poster trials of teaching of how you shouldn't automatically start a program because it looks good, and there's kind of observational evidence and so on and so on. They had been doing it for 20 years in Japan, and they abandoned it after two big studies in Quebec and Germany. And if any of you were born between May 89, in Quebec, who was born between May 89 and April 30, 1994? Any male? You were probably in that study then, a couple of you, yeah. And it turned the whole thing on its head. What they found out was that neuroblastoma regresses and that you can have big, big overdiagnosis. And so it was causing way more harm than good. It was one of the unusual ones. It's a childhood cancer. But it's a wake-up call for people that this can happen. So neuroblastoma is off the map now. All the others have had trials, and the technology has kept moving. But cervical cancer never was put to trial. So the evidence we have for cervical cancer, again, I have a slide at the end, is all non-experimental, not trial-based, geographical, ecological. A lot of it from Canada and a lot of it from the Nordic countries, in particularly the Nordic countries, because Norway started 10 years after the other three Nordic countries. And so beautiful data showing how quickly things happen there. So it's quite nice. So the three I will talk about are the three in red. I'll start with prostate, then colon, and those are from trial data. You see, I have mentioned nothing about, there are trial data from breast, but I'm not going to touch them. They're useless at this point. They're 40 years old. Every time I look at them, they look worse and worse and worse. And so we've gone to population data to look at what's happened for breast cancer screening. But the task forces still go back and re-meta-analyze studies from the 1960s, 70s, and 80s that are useless, worse than useless. But that's what they like to do in task forces. This great evidence, randomized trials, no matter how poor and how old and how small the numbers are, terrible. Yeah. Okay, so if the main message about screening was harm and good, here, I think my main message from the point of measuring is about time. And I'm reminded of this. Some of you know probably where this came from. But in any case, I think it's the opposite with screening. The harm is immediate, and the good is down the road, if at all. Right? That's kind of the point. And I think a lot of the problems we've had with the variation and all the numbers being all over the map in the amount of good people think breast cancer screening does, or colon cancer, or cervical cancer, have to do with really missing out on the first principles. The numbers are just not principles-based, if you like. And they, as I say, it's a question of who and when things happen. So let me just put for you in a minute, because this is now about the proportional hazards model. Sometimes one number reduction, 20% reduction, is a very good number. And it tells you everything there is to know. But sometimes one number is a mess, because it's averaging things that are very different. So let me show you these four. I think there's five of them. These five activities, and whether they reduce the risk of these things in black. Adult circumcision, I'm talking about the risk of acquisition of HIV. These are three trials in Africa. Abdominal aortic aneurysms, that's fixing something that's like a bicycle tire that's bulging, and if you hit a nail in the road, you're gone, right? You have a couple of hours before you, if you don't make it to the hospital and get fixed. Vaccinations. Sudden death in athletes can be prevented in larger sports ones if you screen. Italy is screening young athletes for heart defects so they don't drop dead of something on a track or something like that. What is it about all of these? What is it about all of these to do with time? How quickly does the benefit show, and how long does the benefit last? Vaccines are an easy one. How long does the protection from vaccines last? 20, 30 years until you get a booster, right? But how quickly is the protection there? Why is everyone so quiet? Oh yeah, as soon as the immunity is built up. Yeah. Adult circumcision, gift that keeps on giving. Right? If you let the wound heal. Some didn't and got in trouble. But once, about 6 months on, 40% year after year return on that initial investment. Okay? Vaccines the same. But one thing I'll ask you now, if we vaccinated all girls or boys for HPV at age one, when would we see the benefit? Slightly different issue. It's not. There's nothing wrong with it, but when would we see the benefit there? Only when they become sexually active, right? So it's down the road. So we have, time is important in all of this. When will things happen? When is the threat? And the rest of it. So the main point I would have here is that these reductions or benefits, if you like, reductions in rates of events, they're virtually immediate and sustained, right? And so a one-number summary is good. And an easy way to put that in terms of epidemiology is I can do the same, get the same precision from a randomized trial that randomizes 1 million people and follows them for a year as 500,000 for 2 years, as 250,000 for four, and as 1/20,000,000 for 20 years. See, all the person years are completely interchangeable, or exchangeable, as they say in causal inference. Right? They're all the same. So all you got to do is get the events, and they happen at a standard speed, and away you go. So all of these are great for proportional hazards. But think of how few these are. There's not many that are real life that works like this. That's the one for, no, I'll leave it. Yeah, but there's this other one. What about the effects here? What's the risk of stroke like in relation to taking blood thinners? And what about statins in your cholesterol? What reductions do you get there? Well, you'll get them for as long as you take them. Isn't that right? You'll get them for as long as you take them. You'll get the reductions in cholesterol for as long as you take the cholesterol. As soon as you take the statins off, the LDL goes back. Right? Same with the blood thinners. The people in pharmacoepi know this. They know that some agents, this is only while it's in the body that the person's at risk. Others are different. But you need to know the model. Right, so again, that's one where if we know the time and we know when they came off and on, but it'll go back again towards whatever. So the benefit. Now, here comes prostate cancer now. So what do you think the time pattern is like here? So I'm going to tell you the story. The 180,000 men in those seven countries in Europe randomized to no screening or to screening. Some countries every 2 years, some every four. They were all lumped together. 180,000, followed for 9 years. What do you think the reduction in mortality was in the screening? Do you remember, Paul? No? Hazard ratio is what they... By the way, I would get rid of hazard ratio too and talk about reductions. Why? Are you probably teaching rate ratios as 0.8 and then they have to do 1 minus that to get... We had people go to Ottawa here a few years ago from our program, and they were dealing with HPV efficacy, and they were still quoting rate ratios of 0.05 and 0.1. And I said, no, the vaccine people talk about protection of 90%. They do one minus the rate ratio, or one minus the hazard ratio. Anyway, I call this talking to men. I wouldn't talk to men about a hazard ratio of 80. I would say there's a 20% reduction in your chances of something. Right, so, but what do you notice about it? What do you notice about the graph? They were fine with the number, but they unfortunately gave us the graph. If we should, you know, the graph means they should have been thinking more. Right? What do you notice in the graph? From up at the back, can you see, Robert, any light between those two curves? At what year do you see the light between the curves?
Okay. Seven.
About 7 years. So we have 7 years of no reductions, and then the reductions start. And then they get to be about 50% near the end. So that 20% is an average of 7 years of nothing and 5 years of 30, 40, 50%. So it's a stupid average, plain and simple. So we went back, that's when we got the data. This is a separate story I'll have to tell you later, too long, but quite an espionage story, how we got the data from the graph. They wouldn't give it to us, by the way. So we had to find it ourselves. So what we did is we did something like Mietnin did in that paper in 2002, which was to take the data year by year and look at the reductions year by year. What is the rate in the control and the other, and do rates year by year. There's nothing wrong with that. And because they're not very stable, we did a moving average of three-year windows. So you smoothed it a little bit, right? And Mietnin had single-digit numbers of deaths. I have at least more than that. Let me read it to you. The numbers of deaths at year 6, 29 and 27, 59 and 33, 40 and 25, 40 and 24, 21 and 8, 11 and 3, and then the story stops. Because we're running out of data. You see, almost no follow-up left at the end, because only a few countries are out that far. You see the numbers of Ks there for numbers of people, men being followed. So the fall-off, so all the data come from the front. Just when it's getting interesting, the story stops and the New England Journal publishes it. And it's missing 2 years of data as well that they could have had. They ran the data to 2006, published 2008. The most interesting part were right over the end. So I just basically took moving averages and showed that these hazard ratios have obviously a curve that's heading down, but I don't know where. I don't know when it's going to come back up again. I presume sometime after the last screen. That's what you should expect. Just like when you stop blood thinners or statins, the cholesterol goes up. When you stop screening, at some point, the effect of the last screen will wear off and things will go back to 1 again, to the hazard ratio of 1. Right? Stands to reason. So we don't know when that is yet here. But here's a study we do know where it is. There's 30 years of follow-up in this study. So we can actually see whether when they stop screening, did things finally taper off. It's like having your last drink 7 years ago or 7 hours ago or whatever. Same idea. All right, so here's the study from Minnesota, 30-something year study. FOBT is fecal occult blood. It's now been replaced by FIT, which is still a smear type one that you send in an envelope. And then colonoscopy if needed, if it's positive. So they had two schedules, every year screening or every second year screening, and then a control group. And what do they have? So every year screening, reduction of 32%. Every 2 year screening, reduction of 22%. So not bad. But look at the piece at the bottom here. What do you see at the bottom? There's talk about persistence and sustained effects, right? Do you believe them? Well, it's hard to tell. They give you data, they give you a graph, same kind of graph that's in every screening paper. Do you think that's a persistent effect? Because they were screening for about 10 years. So now there have been 20 years left with no screening. Sammy Suisa isn't here, but if he were, he says, in pharmacoepigenetics, we learn nothing from curves like that. Cumulative curves are the worst thing to Sammy in pharmacoepi. I'd rather have the hazard functions year by year, day by day, month by month. Then we can see what's going on. But you're trying to subtract things with your eye there and doing all sorts of things. You're decumulating it. And that's actually taking the derivative of that function. So, I'm going to play a little game with you for reasons that become clear in a minute. What lottery is this? Can you read it? It says, somebody put the first capsule in the lottery 50 years ago next month. The capsule contained the date September 14. What was the prize? Here.
Vietnam.
You were the first, if you were born September 14, to be called up for Vietnam. So it was a lottery to decide in the order in which people go to Vietnam. And then, how fair was it? Well, does it look fair? So if you're number one, you're called up first. If you're number 366, you were last to be called. Right? So on average, the numbers would be, for any person, any month would be from 1 to 366. So here are 12, what are those? Bar plots? What are they called? Not bar plots. Box plots, right? Yeah. Looks random. It's a bit odd, though, because they're alphabetical, right? The months, they're a strange order. Right? But anyway, here's the data. Same data, but this is January 1 here, and this is December 31. So they're in date order now. The birthdays are in date order along the x-axis, and the y-axis is which order. Number 1 is the early ones. They'll be called first. 365, you'll be called last. So the order of draw versus your birthday. And the birthdays are in time order. So anyone see, whenever I've taught 607, it's a long time ago now, nobody ever complained. They all, do you think this is random? And I've set you up now already, you know. Nobody can see anything. One year, I had a radiologist in the class. And like that, he says, there's a defect in the upper right quadrant. Defect in the upper right quadrant. Maybe you still can't see it. And the point of this graph in Moore and McCabe's stats book is to say sometimes you need to smooth the data to see what the pattern is. You won't see noise, signal from noise. But now organize it by month or smooth it, and you'll see that there's a pattern where the people whose birthdays were in December were pulled out a lot quicker and called much sooner than the ones in January. And it's not just a random thing, it's kind of a monotonic trend as well. Right? Because what happened is they didn't pay much attention and they put the December tickets in last. They were at the top of the drum. They weren't mixed. And the guy didn't have a very long hand, so he just took them from the top. Right? So it's pretty obvious. Now, and this is the New York Times one, which is 50 years ago next January. That's an even more dramatic one. I think that's a better graphic than Moore and McCabe, by the way. Right? Same thing. Right? And look at that headline. There's two papers coming out in the American Statistician soon. One from New Jersey talking about how they fixed this up. And I'm giving in our paper a longer version of all the lotteries they had for the military for the last 100 years. There's another blooper there as well. And they should have learned from... whatever. So now let's go back to this. So here now, we have to try and see what's going on if we looked at these deaths year by year, just like I did with the prostate. Right? I want to look at the death rates and the ratios year by year rather than lumping them all together. So you know in epi, there's two kinds of people. Lumpers and splitters. Right? The lumpers like one number. The splitters want everything broken down. Right? Mietnin says... what's the definition of an epidemiologist?
Broken down by age and sex.
A physician broken down by age and sex. One of the others is just a physician who can count, and the other is a physician broken down by age and sex, right? Paul is blushing. Yeah, so I'm going to give you first a whole lot of options as to how much we split or how much we divide, because we have 30 years. So I can leave it as one number, So there'll be a 0.30, what's that? 32% was a 0.68 hazard ratio and the other was 0.78. So if I leave you those, that's the one on the right-hand side here. Look at that. 0.78 and 0.68, if you just treat it as one average over all 30 years, which is what they did, right? But then I could make it 3 10-year bins, 6 5-year bins, 15 of these, or I could do 30 individual ones, which is way too noisy, right? If you do everything with noise, you can't do anything. Can you see anything there, any pattern whatsoever? Or is it just a flat 30% and 20%? It's very hard, isn't it? You're looking, but you don't see much. No? Do you see any more here? And what I'm going to do here is I'm going to make the windows move so they're not fixed non-overlapping windows, they're moving averages, which means you're sliding the windows along and using 5-5-5 or 2-2-2 and so on. It's a very good trick in epidemiology. So this is the same thing with moving windows, but they're still with the same width, but they're moving. I went around Purvis Hall with this graph and asked people, did they see anything? Joe Cox chosen here. Joe came up with a new curve that I had never heard of before, but I loved it. You know, we have U-shaped curves. What do you think Joe came up with? W-shaped curve. He said, that's a W-shaped curve. I said, where? Where do you see the W? Where do you see it?
Bottom left.
Top right
bottom
and bottom left. Top right and bottom. Why the hell would you get a W-shaped curve? Oh, hi, Inge. Why would you get a W-shaped curve? That means there was some effect, and went away, came back again. Well, actually, in colon cancer, it makes sense. Because colon is unusual in that when you take out polyps, you're actually taking out a precancer. So you're actually getting rid of incidence. You're reducing incidence. And also, you have the screening working also on the mortality of the cancers that are there. So there's two phases to the effects of colon cancer screening. So that's the fancy way of doing it, of explaining it. But there's another way. You didn't read fast enough here. Look at this. Why were they screening from 76 to 82 and from 88 to 90, or whatever it is? Why do you think that was?
Ran out of money.
They didn't run out of money. They miscalculated the power, thought they'd have more deaths, thought they'd loads of power for 5 or 10 years, completely misunderstood. There were no deaths in the beginning, as there shouldn't be. If you start with people who have no diagnosis yet, you're not going to get many die in the first few years. And so they ran out of money, and they had to reapply, and there was a gap of 4 or 5 years in the screening. Sammy loves this graph. Because he says, this is like what we do with withdrawing a drug and putting it back on. That's the way you test whether something is real or not. But here they were withdrawing screening and putting it back. So you got a delay. Things were heading back and then it went down again. And then Amy, with the model we actually worked on for working better ways to parameterize and measure the benefits, Amy was able to then say, well, if that's the case, this is like regression. I can put in those extra values of screens that were missed, and now we get the better effect here, which is way bigger than they had. They just averaged whatever they had. Barely mentioned it, never mentioned it in the whatever. They were happy to get a P less than 0.05 and didn't fuss about putting in the rest, and not even saying that the benefits more than that if you would actually have a program that went on for 15 years. And if you had a program for going for 20 years, it would be even better, which is what you'd probably have in the thing. Now, the rest of the time is on breast cancer. And no trial data from breast cancer, because they're so old, so poor. Every time I read about them, I get more depressed about how they even got in and got to be used for policy. So what we're doing instead, generally, now is saying, look, what's the contemporary world like? What's modern mammography like? And luckily, we have a lot of countries, in Europe especially, that have put in organized breast cancer screening programs by invitation every 2 years or something like that. And they couldn't put everything in at once, so they staggered the introduction. So Denmark is going to be the first example. And this is the second one. But the first one was Copenhagen. They started screening long before everybody else, and they published then later a result, Copenhagen versus what everyone else, before and after. This is the second one. This is from this little area here. I call it Funen, but I can't pronounce the proper Danish way of doing it. This is this little province here. It's about 1/10 of the size of all of Denmark. We can leave Denmark out and use the rest of Denmark as the control. So let me tell you how this works. Have people had the Lexis diagram? No. They don't have it in Europe either, but they're a little better than us. The Lexis diagram, let's start here. We have time or calendar time along the x-axis here. This is the 1st of November, 93. That's when the screening started. Screening was for women from 50 to 70. Okay? So you have age on this axis. So age is on the y-axis, time is on this axis. One of the facts of life, as I know too well, for every year that goes by in the calendar, you have to update your age by 1 year. The slope is one. Okay? So in a Lexis diagram, you travel, and you can find yourself or your mother or somebody here in this one, and you can travel along the diagonal in a Lexis diagram. It's a very, very good bookkeeping thing. Everyone's looking strange at it. It's one of the... I explained it to my aunt in Ireland last year, and she's 87. And I said, where are you? And she knew, what year were you born? What year were you in 1993? And she could then track herself. Very, very easy to track cohorts through the Lexis diagram. So here we have the people from 50 to 70, but they're 71 the next year, 72 the next, and at the end of the follow-up, they'll be this. She had to cut this off here because Denmark started screening everybody at that year. So she wanted to stop it there. But now, this brings up a design issue. What's she going to do to compare before and after? Right? Is she going to just do Funen before and after? Take the same kind of women, years from before versus after, or is that enough? And good epidemiologists that they are, they knew that they'd be criticized for that because treatment, better organization of treatment, it's all improved, so death rates from breast cancer are going down anyway, even in the absence of screening. So you couldn't attribute any decline in time to screening. So they luckily had the rest of Denmark with sort of the same organization of medical care, where they could use this as a control. And then obviously, if you see any improvements here, they have to be subtracted from the improvements you see here. So that's the way to do it. Ireland was late to the organized mammography game. They had no money until they became rich in the late 90s, early 2000s, and then lost it all in the crash again, 2008. But again, it's a question of resources. They couldn't do all the country at once and roll out mammography all at once. So they rolled it out in these 11 eastern counties first, a couple of more in the middle, and then the rest of them here. One sister is here, and I have two sisters here. So all three of them went through the program. At least it was offered to them. I didn't ask them, but they... Yeah. So now let's look at the results. So now you see I have to do double differences, right? Because I have, what was the time change in Funen? What was it in the rest of whatever? So a double difference is a very useful, I see the economists love it here. Yeah. Right? Very, very common. And then you get a one number summary from it, and I'm doing ratios rather than differences here. So, very easy. Look what happened in Funen. You have death rates standardized, age standardized, going from 68 per 100,000 to 47. So you can't claim all of that for screening because things fell by 7 points here as well. But they were pretty close to begin with, but the fall is much bigger in the screened area than the not. So if you do a double difference, which is a double ratio here, you get a 22% reduction over the whole thing. Is it okay?
All good.
Yeah? It's all right though? I call it like AODBC. That's why I put the thing like that. Because you can do it anyway. You can do 68 over 47 divided by the other over the other. It's ABCD. But it's a double. If you want to subtract them, you can subtract them. I said, that's a difference of 21. That's a difference of 7. No, not 21. Yeah, 21. That's a difference of 7. The 47 is the age standardized death rate in that area. It's just age standardized. This is age standardized to the same age. Age standardized, they're all age standardized the same way. So they're just age. You see, basic epi. No fancy models, no anything. There was Cox model and other things, but there's no need for it. Right? It's very, very basic and everyone could get it. Yeah. So that was that. In Ireland, we were not so lucky because in Denmark they had a cancer registry. This is something I didn't appreciate. Cancer registry is essential for these kind of studies, right? Because they were able to use this as a control from previous years. But the cancer registry in Ireland didn't start until the mid-90s. So we came up with another strategy instead. We're still using the Lexis diagram. By the way, here you see screening only goes to 65. They didn't have enough money or resources to go all the way to 70. So it's 15 years. And then you see the same Lexis diagram. So the East has a lot more screening than the West. Right? But again, if we only compared this with this, this would be an East versus West comparison and people would complain. So what else could we do? Why do you think I have the stuff up here? These women, one of them was my mother, were too old in 2000 to be screened, to have been screened. They were past the screening age. But this was what we used as our comparison to make sure. We were comparing two areas of the country, and somebody said, well, maybe the east of Ireland has more cancer in it than anywhere the west. So we said, well, let's look here and here instead. And if they're different, we'll subtract that difference. That's like a baseline from the other. So same idea, except using modern, all 21st century data instead of 20th century data. And so here are the data in my mother's generation in the women too old to have been screened. And what's your impression? And there's deprivation indices for the two areas. So they're not, you know, you can't randomize half of Ireland to one thing and half to the other. It just happened. And of course, the ones in the big cities got there first. But they're not too bad. Huh? The two rates are very close. But the one on the left, that got the earlier screening, has slightly lower death rates, so we'll have to be handicapping them for that again. So we'll have to do another double difference. Right? We have to do a double difference here again. You're looking pained. Is it okay? It's fine. Too easy. Okay.
Jim,
yeah?
What are the different shades of gray?
How many rounds of screening they've had? Yeah. The women who were 64 the year it started only got one round of screening. Two, three. This is why you need a Lexis diagram, right? Because they're traveling their birth cohorts. Yeah, so you can show all this. Yeah, so I then have how many screens? The one at the very top had only one screen, one invitation. Yeah, and then down at the bottom. And the ones here have only just started. Yeah, so that's the idea. We got such awful reviews for this paper initially because they said we were playing games with the data. I said, we're all of us giving you the data. We're not doing any modeling, it's just all in your face. But they thought it was, anyway. Yeah, so here, and then on the bottom, I'm going to show you what happened between the two. Remember, one part of Ireland had an 8-year lead on the other, so 8-year more screening. And I have, well, it's getting late, so I'll have to leave it. So on the bottom, there was a lower death rate here overall 14 years compared to this. But again, we have to do the subtraction, a little bit of a subtraction. This only comes out to 9%. A lot less than the 20 from Denmark. And I think the reason is there wasn't enough of a gap. There wasn't enough of a gap. Right? Because the other started screening. So it's like, well, come on. That's like two groups are screening now. And the further on we go, the more they'll be the same. So I have to go quickly on the rest, but it's all in the papers. And this is now the model that we've produced with Amy's thesis that says, look, you should really be talking about this in a more complicated way. Because first, you brought up the point, there's different numbers of invitations. So averaging over women who've had one and average who have 10, averaging over women in the first year and the 10th year, it makes no sense. The benefit would be further out. So the way we looked at it is this. This is the data from Funen, but all put in one now. So white means no invitation. Black means invitation only in the one area. Right? But all invitations stopped here at 65. So these Funen people had two rounds, four rounds, seven rounds, seven rounds, six. So it's like that. So you should expect bigger deficits in the middle. And at the edges, small deficits. So that's one. The second thing is you should expect the deficits down the road, not immediately. So this is the key part of our model, is this. The key part of the model, if you could look at the blue, I now finally figured out how to explain it. Imagine you have one drink, right? When will the maximum effect of the drink be, right? And it's after so many, after tau units of time. And how deep is the effect there? It's delta. So think of each round of screening as kind of taking a sliver of the deaths away. It's removing slivers, right? But then the next sliver will come from further over because you started a year later. So you're taking away slivers and slivers and slivers, and then they all pile up. It's like taking drinks once an hour, right? And then measuring what happens like the pharmacologists do, right? When we do that, and the two parameters, the key thing in the Amy's model is the two parameters have a meaning. They're the effect of one round of screening. What does one round of screening do? It produces a maximum effect at some point, and then it slides off on both sides. So we were interested in a parameter that says, what does one round do? And here now you can see it. Look at the top row there, the top diagonal. That says that the women who were 68 and 69 and had one round of screening, where's the maximum effect? It's at year 2000, right? It's an 8% dip in mortality at the year 2000. And it's then going off to the side and both sides of it. Down below it, you have the people who got two rounds. That's a deeper one. And so on and so on and so on. So you're basically saying there's a kind of a, we had a bathtub at one point of the model, right? Because it's going down in time, and coming up again. But also, there's different depths for different people. The people at the edges of the bath, if you like, are barely dipping at all because they've only had one round. The ones in the middle are the ones doing the best, and then the others. And we did the exact same thing for Ireland. And here, it's more complicated. Why? Here it was easy because there was screening or no screening. But in Ireland, the second group started screening as well, so you have two sets of curves now. And that explains why you have two sets of curves now. The small ones, not in bold, are the west of Ireland where they didn't even screen yet, so they're getting no benefit yet. And their benefit starts coming in, see, in that direction. But the bigger bold ones are the west of Ireland people, and those are their effects. So again, a much bigger spread from nothing out at the edges, nothing at the front, and presumably at some point in the future, nothing at the back either. But we're not there yet. So that's it. I know we've run way too long, but it's all on the website, including videos, movies, everything. Yeah, so my main summary is to say that stop using one-number summaries for something that can go 30 years. You just can't summarize 30 years in one number. One other thing, I think, is that we talk about invitations. We had a kind of intention or invite type of thing. We didn't get into who took the screens and who didn't. We averaged over everybody. We didn't even know who got the screens anyway. But if you want to talk about from an efficacy rather than effectiveness point of view, you can use these as well to talk about what would happen if women, a certain group of women always had. Right now it's averaged, right, over those who complied and didn't. It would be much bigger because what we see is an average of the compliers and the non-compliers. So we could adjust it upwards to say if women are definitely going to go all the way to the end with it, this is what that group would expect. Yeah. So that's it. And then future work, I leave that. It's mainly looking at population-based data where we haven't got these registries and so on, because it's a lot of work to get these, and you have to do a lot of talking up networks and so on to get people to share data with you. I was lucky I had the data in Ireland and people in Ireland. So there's the funding, and there's the original funding I got to come to Canada 50 years ago. It was £100 and it paid for the Air Canada airfare. Okay, say so. I'm run out of all your time, but I'm happy to stay. You can go if you want. Any questions?
Have you ever tried, because you're making very complex, first, great talk, but because you're making very complex visualization, have you ever thought of working with a graphic designer to see what's available?
I got a comment from a guy in Ireland about this who wrote a book on statistical graphics. Yeah, I challenge him to do it though, but the Lexis diagram is the main one. That's what we're stuck with, right? The Lexis diagram, but that's essential. There's no apologies for the Lexis diagram. It can be made nicer, yeah? The one thing you've got to have is a way of zooming it up so you can see what's going on, because there's an awful lot of stuff in it. But I'm happy to get better suggestions. I didn't get any from the reviewers, but do you have some?
No.
Graphic designer, I don't know. I did get some that they didn't like some of my style and bold and big numbers and small numbers, but I was trying to keep it so I could explain it to my aunt, who's 90. And I, you know, there's no models. Well, at the end there's models, but the rest of it is raw data. Actually, we had raw data even in the Lexis diagram in the paper. But what we did to keep the privacy lid is we used 9 cells, 3x3, and averaged the 9 numbers of deaths, and then put that into the set, and then moved. So we actually have in the paper practically the raw numbers of deaths by year and age. And that's what the IJE people found was too sophisticated. I said, we're giving you the raw data, minus the privacy. Yeah. It's a strange world out there, by the way. If you want to go to screening, be very careful. And this is how long it's going to take you. You know, this is a long distance thing. A long distance activity. When I talked to Schroeder was the head of the ERSPC, the guy where I said the data were running out in 10 years, and I said you got to stay on the job. He was 73. You got to stay on the job and get us the data where the action is. And I said, but Dr. Schroeder, if you were smart, if you had been smart, you would have been a screener for abdominal aortic aneurysm as a stick, and you'd see the benefit after 1 year, and you could have retired at 65. That trial, by the way, got the clinical trial award of the year from the clinical trial journal, the European one, for giving an average of 20%. Oh yeah, sounds like people want to go. I think they've had a long day. All right. Good luck.
Thanks,
yeah.